you're going to find gold.
That's beautifully put, Rachel. And, you know, we intended to have a great conversation today, and I think we pulled it off.
It's been lovely to be here.
Our guest has been Rachel Wiseman. She's reader in philosophy at the University of Liverpool and co-author of Metaphysical Animals, How Four Women Brought Philosophy Back to Life. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I want to highlight one other idea of Anscombe's that we didn't get to in the show, which is that she has this great criticism of Descartes' cogito, I think, therefore I am. So one of the things that Descartes tries to prove is that the body and the mind are different, because he can imagine thinking without a body. But she's like, if that argument worked, he could also prove that he is not Descartes, because he can like imagine, oh, I am not Descartes. So I thought that was a really cool criticism.
Who's the I? Who thinks it's a really cool criticism? Just kidding. I love that. And we're going to put links to that and to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and question everything in our library of more than 600 episodes. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2025.
Our executive producer is James Cass. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Pedro Jimenez, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and question everything in our library of more than 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and we're so happy to have you here on this Friday, January the 17th. It is a chilly one, but we, you know, it's winter and it's Michigan, and what did you expect, right? Who knows what could happen next, but we are knowing full well what is happening next here at HFC, and it's an event that we are super excited to share some insight with you, our wonderful loyal listeners. So after a successful launch of a concert series that you might recall from about a year ago, maybe a little longer, Henry Ford College's music department is again hosting a second installment of a fun mashup, if you will, between a musician, a local musician, and a big band, the big band here at Henry Ford College. And we are super excited to be talking with two people that are instrumental, there's the pun, had to get that out, to this event that we absolutely would love you to come to. Come and attend this event. It is, again, tomorrow, January 18th, 7 p.m. taking place at the Adre Auditorium here at Henry Ford College. It is the F building at the very back of campus. There is a ticket price, but it is going to a wonderful cause. So we're going to let the experts tell you a little bit more about this. But I am very excited to welcome our featured bassist, Trevor Lamb, who is going to be providing most of the entertainment with some support, certainly. trust me. We'll get you. And then also Anthony Lai, who is our head of HFC Music here. And we are just really excited to welcome both of you to the Journal. And wow, so this is, we'll start with Anthony, I think. So this is the second one, Anthony, the first event that we enjoyed so much. It was a jazzy, big bandy kind of a thing. Really fun. And what a great mashup with a wonderful female vocalist from this community. But the concept of this show, I think, is pretty unique, and it's I'll let you tell the story. How did this come together, and what's sort of the motivation behind these sort of successful concert series that we're moving forward with?
Sure. Well, it comes from the fact that we have such a wide variety of talent all throughout Metro Detroit, and they don't always have the means to be seen in all of the places that maybe that would be nice to have them. And not everyone can afford to hire a big band. And so we're looking for new things to do. And so we started it with Olivia, this idea that here's someone who's very organized and really putting herself out there, but can't just like pay for the, what, 16, 17 people in a big band. So we're like, well, rather than hire us, why don't we collaborate on a concert? You bring your audience, we bring ours, and then it's mutually beneficial. And it went over really, really well. And so we were trying to figure out what other type of musician would we want to highlight. And we came across Trevor, who runs a successful jazz jam or open mic. Trevor, what would you call it?
A jam session.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of an open mic, right? For like, you know, like any other artist, like comedians and have their open mics, right? Singer-songwriters have their open mics, right? And so the jam session is just the jazz musician's equivalent of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Trevor does such a good job of bringing jazz musicians from around the community together that we thought, well, here's an opportunity for someone who's a fantastic musician and just a great hang, someone who can really like bring the sense of community to the jazz world. Why don't we give him an opportunity to showcase everything he's about with the big band? And so that's where this one came about.
Well, that sounds brilliant. And Olivia Van Gore is the Olivia that Anthony is speaking of. And we hope you had the chance to experience that last concert. But if you didn't, and especially if you did, you're going to want to come back for this. You're going to want to come back for more. The venue is great and comfortable, and it'll be warm inside, and our hearts will warm with some of the very spectacular pieces that Trevor and the accompaniment of the HFC Big Band will share. Trevor, it sounds like you have kind of been around, done a lot of stuff, but you're still a pretty young guy as I'm looking at you. And I know that that you're a young man, but one that is bringing experience probably beyond your years, because I've heard your music and I've read your bio and it's pretty significant. So what's all this about with you? What's this whole music connection that you have? Why do you do this?
You know, I first started playing music because I didn't want to sing in choir in elementary school. I started playing the trombone because I didn't like the teacher. And then I just, you know, I continued to do it all the way through school. And I had a really excellent, band director in high school who, you know, really, showed everyone how much passion he had for music. So then it made a lot of kids develop that. And I basically fell, I love playing rock music with my brothers. And so I started playing bass. And then, as we were talking about before, we had a high school jazz band. And so that, and that's when I really started getting into jazz. Right. And I met my college private lessons teacher, Paul Keller, through in that high school big band, and then went to Wayne. And like Anthony said about Detroit, there's an excellent community of all kinds of musicians, all kinds of artists, and especially the city has really deep ties in jazz history. And so, you know, I started playing bass at Wayne State, and I was really given the opportunity to learn how to play the music through playing gigs. I started playing gigs when I was like 19. And one of the early on, I actually played in a choir gig with Anthony for the Seaway Chorale too. But so I really was blessed in the opportunity to just learn how to play on the bandstand, which is a rare thing to do in, especially 2025 or 2016 back then, you know? And so I got that's what kind of led to all this. And so I'm kind of lucky enough to been playing gigs now for almost 9 years. You could consider me a professional musician. I'm only 27. So it's been a real blessing to just kind of stumble into this music scene that I had no clue I was living just underneath my whole life.
That's a really interesting way to put it, Trevor. And I understand you have not only done your sort of homage to the Detroit jazz scene, but sort of brought that with you to even other parts of the country and other countries, even touring in Japan, I understand. So,
so you kind of
are international here, I suppose.
A little bit. The most international coverage I think I get is Windsor, but you know, we play a lot in Windsor. But no, I'm extremely lucky and blessed to have gone on. I got to be a part of the Tory Detroit reunion ensemble for the Detroit Jazz Fest in a good handful of years, maybe 3 years ago now. And then with that, I got to do a saxophone tour trio of three different cities in Japan over 10 days with Chris Collins and on saxophone and Sean Dobbins on the drums. And that was the coolest thing I think I've ever done. This is definitely right underneath the being featured on a big band concert. That I got this call from Joe about in February last year, Joe LaRusso, the manager of the band, he plays alto. And I'm like, I was shocked when he asked me to do it. Cause I'm like, I play the bass, man. It's like, you want to feature the bass player? You're going from singer to bass player. It's kind of, it's a big step in the spotlight, you know?
Well, we're putting a lot of trust in Joe, and we think that he knows what he's doing. We know he knows what he's doing, and that's why you're here, and that's why Anthony's here. That's why we're talking about this event. Again, it's literally tomorrow, and there are seats available. So it starts at 7 o'clock. There is a ticket promo through WHFR. You can use a promo code WHFR20 to get tickets for just $20. So this is very unique and special only to our listeners. So don't tell anybody else. No, you can share it with whoever you want. But we do really hope that our wonderful loyal listeners will represent at this show. And you can certainly, you know, get more information online on the HFC site. And we'll give you another area to actually physically acquire the tickets on the Internet if you want to, if you don't have that promo code handy. But I have to ask, I think, and this would be, I suppose, for Anthony, the opportunity for the bands that come through Henry Ford College and are directly affiliated with Henry Ford College and sort of a step over to our partnering, neighboring, just community of musicians. It seems like many of the big band and other band members were just there recently or are already, you know, doing their own thing, their own side gigs and stuff. So what sort of makes this unique, the difference between playing in a school environment, playing out at gigs versus just like, you know, kind of playing in your basement with your friends to prep and practice? I mean, what's the difference here? What is unique about the sound that we're going to experience with this tomorrow?
Yeah, so the Henry Ford Big Band is made up of a lot of local band directors, professional musicians that play in cover bands, orchestras, all sorts of things around town. And we got a good handful in the band that were once Henry Ford students that played in the Studio 110 jazz band here that sort of, quote, graduated to the big band after, you know, putting in their time and really getting their chops up to speed and being able to, you know, sit with the at the adult table, so to speak. So it's a cool band because at any point, if I had to just walk off stage and say, I'm out of here, any one of them could stand up and be the director. I mean, there's so many fantastic musicians in the band that it's a unique experience. And so it doesn't take much for this band to get concert ready. You know, everyone knows the expectations of putting on a good show, and so they bring it.
Awesome. And Trevor, the idea of sort of kind of being raised as a sort of a gig musician versus having to do all that, you know, putting in those dues and that time sort of off the spotlight. Still, each one's got to be pretty special, and this one's certainly so unique, as you said.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, so I, you know, it's a blessing each and every time you get to play in a nice theater, you know, let alone with a great big band behind you, you know. And so I host a Tuesday night jam session like we've talked about before, and I love this bar. It's very near and dear to my heart. But, you know, it's just a stage at a bar. But it's nice to sometimes, you know, try to sell some tickets. You know, it's a nice thing. You really put thought into like programming because, you know, a lot of these things, because they happen. You know, I play every Tuesday in Melvindale, and then I have two Friday and Saturday night regular gigs at a bar downtown. It's a nicer, you know, it's a cocktail bar, right? You know, so there's a, it's a little bit up. People are wearing suits. you know, it's a little bit better, but you're not on a stage, right? So it's nice to just put the music that you care about on a nice spotlight and really, you know, like I play so many gigs a month that it's hard to, you know, they some don't stand out, right? So it's nice to have something like this to be like, hey, people I really care about, you know, I know you can't make it to every one of my gigs, but here's a gig that I think is really special that I would love to see you at. And it's nice to have things like that in the book to kind of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel if you're in the rut of going through playing the background gigs, you know, but which I love. It's a total blessing. I am, again, the luckiest man in Detroit for things we've already talked about. But yeah. It's great. It's nice to be able to put a spotlight on the music you care about.
Yeah, oh, it's a super attitude, Anthony. If we could clone this attitude, right, and put it in every single person that we
absolutely
on day one. Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
You mentioned the putting music that you love in the spotlight. I know that there's some collaboration again in terms of sort of the style of music that we're going to hear, what we're going to be presented with tomorrow at the concert. So will one of you, and you don't give away all the secrets, but just a little sampling of what pieces we can expect, just to sort of whet people's appetite for this event.
Yeah. So, you know, I like to get across the idea that jazz is not a genre. It's a way of creating, right? So there's lots of things that you can call jazz and it can sound all different ways. So we tried to capture some of that by putting some classic, you know, Duke Ellington pieces like Perdido in there. And then we have some classic Count Basie big band pieces like April in Paris, right? To kind of set the scene and feature how good of a big band we have behind, like playing the whole concert, right? And then we tried to move through to play some more modern music to include, or maybe some lesser known pieces by some of these greats, right? So we have a couple compositions. We have one composition by Carla Bley, a phenomenal female composer of, you know, more modern jazz, more contemporary jazz. And then I'm featuring some, there's a medley of songs that a pianist and singer that I play with a lot, William Michael Harrison, I have a medley of his three songs. And then we're featuring one piece by a great composer and guitarist from Detroit. He arranged one of his songs, Heartstrings, for the big band to feature me. And I'm so excited to give some of my friends an opportunity to hear their music on such a big platform too. So that's what I'm looking forward to. Cause again, these are great musicians and more people need to hear their music.
Yeah. Super cool. This is an event that we will be broadcasting on WHFR, but I have to make sure that everybody promises that you will only listen to the broadcast if you absolutely cannot attend the show live, right? Because the point of this type of music is to experience it live. That's the magic, the special sauce of an event like this. So we're super excited to have, you know, we want to fill that auditorium and get people out there to experience this really once in a lifetime opportunity. And Trevor, we know that you will have more opportunities in different venues. But I think if the point of this, HFC Music Presents is to feature a different artist every time or a different musician or someone in the music world, you may not, you know, cycle back in the mix for a while. So this is a really good opportunity to see Trevor perform live in this brilliantly accompanied, you know, way. And this is benefiting our Henry Ford College Music Program. Anthony, will you just talk a little bit about that? I did mention that $20 fee for the tickets. That's if you mention that I'll give you the coding. I have to find it again here. But tickets are typically $29. And still, that's, you know, not much when you're talking about what we're going to get with this caliber of live entertainment. So tell us a little bit about the angle and how we're benefiting your program.
Sure. You know, a university, when you go to university and study music, you start on the, you know, if there's three jazz bands, like at Wayne State, I think there's Jazz Lab Band 1, 2, and 3. And you probably start on Lab 3, unless you came in with some real good chops, and you kind of aspire. You go to the jazz concerts and you see the top band and you really know what you're aiming for eventually. And at a community college, we're lucky that we have Studio 110. A lot of community colleges don't get a jazz band at all. And the great thing about the Henry Ford Big Band is that it gives us essentially our Jazz Lab One. And so when our students go see a fantastic concert like this, they see a 27-year-old bass player taking a spotlight with a fantastic band. They see all the different things they could aspire towards. You know, can I be the guy who rallies all the local troops to come to a jam every week? Can I be the person who gets chosen to have an arrangement performed on a one-time show? There's so many things to aspire to. And I'll tell you what, when I was a student, seeing a really good concert, there's no better learning experience than just seeing all. And this concert in particular, if you think, you know, an hour, hour and a half, however long this ends up being of jazz with a bass player being featured could get monotonous. I think this is the most eclectic and cool concert I have done with a jazz band. You just like the charts he brought in, Trevor brought in, and then the charts that we chose as a band. It's just created a program that highlights not just bass and not just how good of a bass player Trevor is, but his understanding of what jazz can be and what jazz bass can do. And it is far beyond what you might think if you just close your eyes and think of a big band concert with a bass player. And so I not only applaud his chops and his ability to just make everyone in the room want to play well for him, but I applaud his ability to understand how to program a concert that's going to keep everyone engaged the entire time. I mean, that's really, to me, a total package, and I'm just proud to be part of it.
Trevor, no pressure there, buddy, but we know this is going to be incredible. We absolutely do, and we really want you to be in this audience and enjoy it and celebrate it with us. Again, tomorrow, January 18th, get your tickets in advance, please. And again, I found that promo code. How could I have forgotten? It's WHFR20, simple as that. You can go to Eventbrite. You can basically just a basic Google search or anywhere, any online search, Trevor Lamb Concert HFC, and it will pull up ways to actually purchase these tickets online. And we absolutely encourage you to do so. It is featured during with Eventbrite and all events. There's even a piece with the Dearborn Area Chamber covering this event as well. So it's being well represented, but we wanted to make sure that we do our part and share both our excitement and enthusiasm for this event even happening, but then also invite you, especially with that promo code, to save you a little bit of money, but again, proceeds benefiting the HFC Music Department. It is a win-win actually for all of us, for the artists, for the music department, and especially for us with the pleasure and privilege of being in the audience. So super excited about this. We wish you all the best, Trevor, in this journey called music that you have clearly made your life's passion. We know Anthony is already, you know, doing that every single day with our students here at HFC, but we wish you great continued success and cannot wait to see this brilliant show tomorrow. Final thoughts? Any last bit of enticement or advice you'd like to share with the audience?
Jazz is something that needs to be practiced on a live audience. And more, a live audience is something that is tuning in. And please do that if, again, you can't be there. But if you can be there, come out tomorrow. It's great. It's so much better to see anything live. Think about how much more fun it is to see a movie in a movie theater versus your living room. So come on out, get the ticket, use the promo code. You will not regret it.
Great analogy. Thank you. Anthony, final thoughts?
Yeah. I just want to reemphasize once again, you know, the spotlight is usually attained by those who dedicate their life to finding it. And I think one of the things I'm really happy about with this concert is Trevor is the type of musician who's not looking for a spotlight. He's looking to have a good time and make good music. And it's nice to reward something that genuine with the spotlight that I don't know if he would necessarily go looking for on his own.
nope.
You know, so it's going to be a very real show. It's my type of it just the, in terms of ideology, it's I think it's an important show. And hopefully if you can see it live, you know, every rehearsal is different because it's jazz. And so the concert, it really is one night only. If we were to do it twice, it's still one night only, you know.
We are so happy to be a part of this. And obviously, that's what we do at WHFR, is to provide programming that is just not being heard anywhere else. And certainly looking in our own backyard, or in this case, well, currently Hazel Park, right, with where Trevor's residing, but literally right here on the campus of Henry Ford College, Evergreen Road in Dearborn, tomorrow, January 18th, 7 p.m. Doors will open probably by 6:30. We certainly encourage you to come out. Again, promo code is WHFR20 to get those $29 tickets for $20, and simply search Trevor Lamb Concert, HFC Music, and you'll find the way to get the tickets, and we hope to see you. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for your time, your passion, and your commitment to the world of music. I don't know what life would be like without it, and we're so grateful to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All the best. We've got more to come. This is the WHFR Journal right here on 89.3 FM. Susan McGraw with you. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm wondering about life-changing reading experiences. My thought partner is a friend, the great actor and writer and professional observer, Anna Deavere Smith. You might remember her from West Wing. She was recently in Black-ish and Inventing Anna. She has done some groundbreaking theater that totally floored me. I would recommend to you Notes from the Field on HBO. It's dynamic and sophisticated and important, and she's here to talk with me about two books which have had a profound effect on her, Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Dibs in Search of Self by Virginia Axline. So join me for Kelly Corrigan Wonders and my conversation with Anna Deavere Smith. My conversation partner today is actress and writer Anna Deavere Smith. I interviewed Anna back in 2022 for my PBS show, Tell Me More, and we've had a good time together since. She is a joy to know and a fascinating creative who has developed a singular way of inhabiting characters that involves interviewing real people and presenting their words verbatim. She literally becomes the people she has interviewed on stage, adopting their posture, their verbal tics, their accents. She gets it all just right. And through this, is able to highlight social issues in a way I've never seen done before. Today, Anna's here to talk about not one, but two books that have stuck with her in important ways. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from a Birmingham Jail and Dibs in Search of Self by Virginia Axline. First up is Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And if you haven't read it, or you read it a long time ago, here's the quick backstory. It's April 1963, and Martin Luther King has been locked up for protesting racism, nonviolently, in Alabama. And while he's in jail, he's given a copy of the local newspaper where 8 white Alabama clergymen have argued that his actions are unwise and untimely. He knows he needs to respond, but he has no paper. So in the margins of the newspaper, he starts jotting down his thoughts about just and unjust laws, the distorting, soul-crushing impact of segregation. And eventually, his lawyer manages to sneak in sheets of writing paper during a visit. The result is this enduring piece of writing in defense of nonviolent resistance. It's as logical as it is lyrical. It's thorough and persuasive, and quickly became a foundational text for the civil rights movement. Anna has spent an inordinate amount of time with this text in preparation for a performance she did of the letter as Martin Luther King Jr. that I encourage you to watch on YouTube. Okay, here's my conversation with Anna Deavere Smith. Deavere Smith, who were you the first time you came in contact with Letter from Birmingham Jail? How old were you? Were you in Baltimore? Were you a high school kid? Had you ever been to a protest?
No. Well, there are a lot of no's and one yes. I mean, by the time I read Letter from Birmingham Jail, I was an adult.
Interesting.
I don't know. Yeah. In fact, I was, it's not that long ago. maybe 10 years ago.
No kidding. I'm so surprised. I felt like when I was revisiting it, I thought if I ever teach English class or speech and debate, I'm going to start with this because it's so well written. It's so well constructed. It's like an airtight argument.
Well, when I went to high school, Martin Luther King was controversial in a different way. There's no way we would have been reading Letter from a Birmingham Jail.
Yeah.
I don't even know if there's a school in Baltimore that would have been reading it. In fact, do you think now it's standard in high schools even?
I think it is. I mean, I think it is definitely on some reading lists. And as well, it should be. I mean, one could learn a lot about a lot of writing techniques and a lot of oratory techniques, really studying this with a highlighter in your hand. Like even early on when he says, basically, you tell me, how should I explain it to my six-year-old when she sees an advertisement for an amusement park and then I have to tell her she can't go? Like that's one of those examples of specificity that speaks the larger truth that, you know, you and I are both always striving for in our work.
Well, I would say, is it a larger truth or is it trying to, it's hoping for empathy that that specific of a child will work? I don't know if it necessarily would, do you know what I mean, back then, but he's talking to clergy, so we would hope that.
So let's set it up a little bit. It's 1963. You are 13 years old. You are in middle school in Baltimore somewhere?
Where was I? Let's see. We didn't have middle school. We had junior high. So I was probably in, I was either in ninth or 10th grade because I skipped a grade. Either ninth or 10th grade.
Clever girl. No surprise to me that you skipped a grade.
No, actually what they did was they took about five of us and we all skipped at once. And we were in this lab school. I'm not so sure why we did. I think it was some idea, some experimental idea. I don't think it was that I was so special because like about five or six of us skipped.
Yeah. So what did your family talk about when they talked about Martin Luther King?
He wasn't a uniform God. Let's put it that way, right? Some people thought that he was, believe it or not, radical. Although, you know, there's that wonderful part in Letter from a Birmingham Jail where he stresses that he preaches nonviolence and that what's coming down the pike are people who are going to be violent. You know, there are people who are not going to be coming out of what he's coming from. So I don't think anybody in 1963 in my small circle of Black folks in Baltimore could have anticipated, for example, the Panthers.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when he calls out Jesus as a radical, Abraham Lincoln as a radical, Thomas Jefferson as a radical, like that things look radical at first. And that if there had been a person, say, in Nazi Germany who chose to break the law, which is really fundamentally what this whole letter is about, is why did I break the law? And I broke the law because some laws are unjust. And then he points out all these other laws around the world that we've all come to see as unjust and worthy of breaking as a first step toward curing a particular piece of society.
Well, I mean, it's also, you know, I've performed it, the piece, and as more and more of the references become religious, the closer you get to Jesus, the more emotional it becomes. And I think it's important to remember that the letter is being written to clergy. And I almost see the letter as a broken heart of a broken relationship, which is his disappointment. I believe that as it comes closer to the end and he talks about his disappointment with those clergy and his disappointment with the church, which he warns is going to become an irrelevant social club. And it has. since that time in so many ways. I don't even know about the social club part, but many parts of America, many parts of my life have become very, very secular, you know, the further I go from my Baltimore roots. And so I see the letter as a profound broken heart, a profound disappointment that Christianity can't reach far enough.
Yeah.
I wonder what Martin Luther King would think about the Christian evangelists now, the way that the right wing has grabbed Jesus. Wonder what he would say about that.
Yeah. Yeah, because what happened was he had been jailed for misbehavior in public, which was really just protesting. And then somebody snuck a letter that had been printed in the newspaper from a group of white clergymen into the Birmingham jail. And Martin Luther King saw it. And this was his response to it, was like, wait a minute. I thought we were on the same page. I thought we were all radicals for love and acceptance and desegregation and togetherness. And now I'm starting to see that your moderate milquetoast views might be more dangerous to us than the KKK.
Right. Well, should we be radicals for love, as a matter of fact, right? You know, it's also the case that if you get a chance to talk to his lawyer, Clarence Jones snuck into the jail paper. Like, you could never do that now, right? He didn't get patted down, but he snuck paper in. So he was writing on all kinds of paper, you know, restaurant checks, whatever he could get. So he's also writing in a fever. And we see, too, that his extraordinary ability to recall, I guess you'd call that an autodidact, is how you say that, because he's able to quote at length all of these different Christian and Jewish philosophers. And at one point, the Jewish philosophers, which I wonder if it's conscious on his part, make a better argument. You know, he evokes Buber, Martin Buber, at one point. I-thou relationships would choose to look at you like a thou, like a you or an it.
Yeah, say more about that. I thought it was very interesting how many people he brought into his argument. Like, he brought in Socrates and he brought in
St. Augustine.
And then he brought in this rabbi who makes this point that when you shift, remind me if this is right, if you shift from I to it versus I to thou, you're making...
Well, people become things.
People become things.
And he talks about segregation actually as a sin. And just to say how secular we are, when I was anticipating quoting that part of the letter, and I don't have the letter in front of me right now, where he calls segregation a sin, I worried about how a modern audience will hear the word sin. Will that alienate them from the argument for a second? That's just how secular we are.
Were you from a religious childhood?
Yes. I mean, I think it would be very hard to grow up in Baltimore, Maryland at the time that I did, in a Black community, and not be religious. You know, you sort of ask people, you know, what church do you go to? You sort of evaluate how they are in this competition between churches. So I don't know if it's religious in the way of devout, but it was a part of my life. You know, it was just, you didn't think about it. It was like the air that you breathe.
Was it deep inside you, or was it a thing you did once a week with your family because that's what people did? Like, did you feel it?
Well, I think that if you say, do I feel it, that I get the Holy Spirit or something like that? No. But I would say that what came with religion, and it's in the letter from Birmingham jail, is an idea that was more felt than I could say. It was a profound idea about goodness. What it meant to be good, I would say, was really powerful. And I see that in our opportunity to be good, you know, King making a strong argument for that. And again, his disappointment that goodness is not in the white Southern Christian community.
Right, that they didn't see each other as brothers. When you think about a childhood in a community that's kind of steeped in these ideas of goodness that are repeated back to a congregation weekly. So they're just kind of reinforcing this ethical messaging. And then you have somebody who is on the national stage who's overtly rooted in his religion, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And then you think about today, what do you think the gains are and what are the losses in terms of our move toward a more secular society?
I think that we are, to quote a now rather controversial rabbi, Rabbi Wolpe, said to me several years ago when I interviewed him, he said, you know the story, he said, the rabbis tell the story about the person who said, I'm only making a hole in my side of the boat. It's an absurd idea. You can't make a hole only in your side of the boat. And I think that's how we live now. I mean, I think that art tries every once in a while to be a kind of a secular religion, but maybe not even. I don't know. I would have to ask you, like, how do you think about goodness? Where do you look to ask yourself if you're on the right track? And does it matter?
Well, it definitely matters. I definitely think about it. It's definitely a part of my calculation and the choices that I make of projects to take on. And I'm definitely nervous sometimes that I'm taking too much care of myself and not enough care of the larger community. And I do wonder if the kinds of sacrificial moves that Martin Luther King is talking about in Letter from Birmingham Jail, which is to say that, like, love requires some level of sacrifice. And I am happy to be in this jail if this is what it requires, to point out over and over and over again what a humiliating setup we have across society here. Like, we're changing the personalities of these young people. I thought that was one of the most poignant parts of it, that we're changing the personality of these young Black people who, at a young age, because they are being deformed by the way they're being treated. And so I definitely think about, every time we book a new podcast, I think, is this a conversation that's to the greater good? Is this about something more than just me amusing myself or me being a lifetime learner in public, but rather, like, could this help other people who are also trying to learn some things and trying to grow and trying not to stagnate? I also do not have religion. And it's come up more than once as we look back on books that you can see when you're reading from the canon that's assigned in high school and college, that religion was way, way, way bigger as a part of everyday life and everyday thinking for people than it is right now for most people.
Listen, I had a wonderful opportunity, a very beautiful opportunity to be in residence at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco.
What a beautiful place.
Which is one of the places, it's a beautiful place. It's one of the places that I read A Letter from a Birmingham Jail, accompanied by Bobby McDuffie, a classical violinist, and an extraordinary place to read that out loud. And when I told people that I was going to Grace Cathedral to be artist in residence, one individual who worked with me said, you're going to the the monastery? It's not a monastery. I mean, it's like this extraordinary cathedral where Martin Luther King spoke, actually, and drew the biggest crowd in its history until September 11th. Or when I was in Aspen, I would go on a regular basis to a monastery, which is now closing down, sadly, St. Benedict's, and made a very good friend of one of the monks there. And people have, like, you know, why? Well, they're weird. Monks are weird. So there's this way that it's not just that it's not cool, but that is something weird about it that I think is really unfortunate in terms of, did we throw the baby out with the bathwater? And I think The other thing in particular about Martin Luther King in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, when he names the people that he named, many of them had made sacrifices or were jailed themselves, right?
Or killed.
Or killed. And so he saw himself in that tradition.
Yeah. And now, just as you say, monks are weird. Now we have learned to distrust religious leaders. We've learned to worry that maybe they're going to make money off the back of their congregation to their congregation's detriment, or they're going to hurt the children of their congregation, or. And so once that sort of emotional barrier slips into place, that these people aren't necessarily the trusted authorities we once thought of them as automatically, then you wonder how somebody like Martin Luther King Jr. would do in today's environment.
Well, it's also that some people think, would he be welcome at his own birthday party? Because he was radical. You know, I love the part of Letter from Birmingham Jail where he says, you know, you want to call me an extremist. You want to basically want to indict me as an extremist. But maybe the question is, shall we be extremists for love or shall we be extremists for hate? And we're certainly in that moment in our country right now. And the question for me would be, we're talking about the secularization of our world and what did we lose from that? But also, have we lost the ability for love to be agape love? Is that animated in us? And if so, where?
Yeah, the other thing that's in there is this really strong pushback on the idea of like, wait. Just hold on, Black people. It's coming, Black people. Have a little patience, Black people. Like, that's what the white pastors were sort of suggesting in the letter that Martin Luther King's responding
to. It's
just
fast.
Like,
yeah.
Hold your horses, be patient.
Untimely.
Yes. And what he says in the letter is, time is neutral. It does not act to heal. In fact, time is an ally of stagnation. And so if you believe that, which I really, when he was talking to me, when he was in my ear reading this letter, I believed it. Like, I believed every word he said when I heard him say it over the course of this past week as I was listening to it repeatedly. Then extremism is the call. Then falling into kind of a moderate incrementalist move is being lulled into a state of inaction, and you'll wake up 5 years later and you would have accepted the same conditions for five more years.
That's right. And some of the people that he alludes to, you know, the Negroes who were so beaten down by everything in Jim Crow and segregation that they've lost their urgency. You know, he talks about those as well.
Coming up next, Anna tells me why she views her art as a form of protest. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders and Anna DeVere Smith.
When it comes to a gun suicide attempt, all it takes is a moment.
Heather and I had an argument just like any other couple. I was lost. I had snapped. I had a gun and I was going to take my own life. Heather helped me realize that there was still a life to live for the better of myself, my family. My weapon is now safely put away.
A moment of crisis can happen to anyone. Store your guns locked, unloaded, and away from ammo. Hear more safe stories at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Okay, let's pick up my conversation with writer and performer Anna DeVere Smith. Have you protested a lot in your day?
I didn't, you know.
Is there a reason? Like, do you think it's ineffective?
Oh, I think protest is very effective. When I was in school in London in the 60s, I protested. When I was living in San Francisco, there were always opportunities to protest. I think my work is a protest. I think that's what has ended up being my spirit of protest is... It's in my work. I would love some of my works to cause protests if necessary, Yeah, I think of my work as a form of protest.
For sure. I mean, so for the uninitiated, if there's anyone out there, a thing Anna does that I love is that she interviews people for long, long periods and has this total commitment to recapturing them on stage for audiences. So she'll talk to a longshoreman and then she'll literally like become this person. I mean, that your acting skills when you're doing these one-woman shows that you can watch on HBO anytime you like are uncanny. The way you capture people's voices and their ums and their ahs and their eyebrow raise and their little verbal tics. But what you're doing, I feel, is showing people the people that people are not looking at. How do you think about what you're doing when you capture all those voices and put them together in a one-woman show and bring them to life for us, one character after another?
Well, I mean, I think it's actually the inquiry is the other part of it, like before it's on stage, which is that I don't go with a frame of mind. I don't go with what I'm specifically looking for. And I try to open myself to a variety of points of view as much as possible. And then the point is less to give voice, because I don't think I give voice. I think people have voice already. But to try to bring to the light things people don't want to look at. You know, there's this beautiful passage that was a lot to try to learn, very emotional, right here in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, when he talks about bringing hidden tension out into the open. He says, we bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with. Like, this is the part, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. Injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. And so when I say that I think of my work as protest, actually looking at discord and looking at the darker things and bringing them into light. Now, you know, to do that and have people watch, there have to be other things that they're looking at. It's a little bit of a sleight of hand, but I do believe that that's one thing that art can do. Art can do that. It can bring up the stuff that language, even when we think we're talking about, that language somehow covers up. I think that's one. Art can be a form of protest in as much as it can seek to show the unseen, even in a peculiar way that would cause you to look at it more carefully. So in me acting like other people, the goal was just to use that trick, really, to get people to pay attention. But it's not in and of itself to go, oh, wow, you look like so-and-so. Or, you know, even in working with Letter from a Birmingham Jail, and King never performed it, he only read it. The goal for me was to try to bring to life the amount of emotion that was underneath this brilliant writing.
Yeah, and he's doing the same trick that you're doing, which is to say he's got such verbal charm that you're
virtuosity.
You cannot stop. You know, you're just getting pulled in and wrapped around his finger with every beautifully phrased sentence. And once you're in, then there is this opportunity to open your eyes to something. And you mentioned the word tension, and I thought there was this really interesting distinction that he was making between kinds of peace. So peace as the absence of tension, or peace as the presence of justice.
That's pretty brilliant right there.
Pretty brilliant, because it's like that thing about how the near cousin of a thing is the most dangerous antibody to the thing, which is to say, if you feel an absence of tension and you mistake that for peace and you feel that you have achieved a state of peace, you're missing the real thing. The real win is the presence of justice. But the near cousin is like nobody's fighting out loud. It feels kind of peaceful around here. But that's not peace. That's repression.
And also, it's very, the way you talk about it is justice becomes a very active idea, right? We can't just think we can go to sleep and it's just going to be there. It's very active.
Yes, it requires our participation at all times, basically.
At all times.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the great lessons of the last few years is that it's not one and done. You can't like turn the page and say, rock on, democracy, established, check. It's like, oh my God, you got to watch it every day. You got to track it every day. You got to keep showing up. You picked another book that I had never heard of before called Dibs. How did you come to this book? How old were you when it was handed to you?
I was a junior in college. It was required reading in a psychology course, Dibs in Search of Self. And it was written by a woman called Virginia Axline, and she wrote an accompanying book called Play Therapy. But I think the book became very important to me because even though it was required reading, it really spoke to my soul. And what spoke to my soul was this therapist finding a way to understand this kid who appeared to be very troubled. It turned out he was a genius. And also discovering that to treat the kid, she had to treat his mother. And I think it's less about the specifics of that book and more about, and this has to do with my work now, how important imaginative care is. I think about the fact that I would have never thought when I read Dibs in Search of Self as required reading that down the line I would be invited to be a visiting professor at the School of Psychiatry at Stanford by the head of child psychiatry. And the work that I'm doing now is about girls and how they survive, girls who come from tough backgrounds and how they survive. And it comes after my play about the school-to-prison pipeline, which I thought at the time that we started getting very interested in incarceration and mass incarceration in the country, we weren't really talking about kids. But at the end of that big project of interviewing 250 people in five different geographic areas and writing a play that became also a HBO film, that we think about the most vulnerable kids as often boys, I would say. And yet I wanted to know about girls. And in working with them, I realized, because you asked me about a book, and that is truly, for some reason, one of the most powerful books I had read to that point in my life, that I'm not doing therapy and I'm not doing what was play therapy to get to know these girls, but I've created a pedagogy called performance as a way of knowing. And I'm using art and artists as a lens to learn about them and learn about their lives. And so I think that deep back then, before I even thought of being in theater, didn't know what I was going to do, the book was transformative, perhaps, because psychology is a science. But there was so much imagination and real love, real agape love for this kid called Dibs. And she unlocked him. You know, she figured out what was going on and she helped him. He was probably on the spectrum, which we would call now. But in 1969, or when Virginia Axline wrote that book, nobody was talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, he was completely unknowable when he came to her as a child. He would give up nothing. And she had to find all these ways through play therapy and really open-ended explorations to let him discover himself right in front of her. And the devotion that she showed to him was essential to it working.
Yeah.
And the non-directive nature of the therapy, which wasn't like, I'm going to put out these breadcrumbs and you're going to follow them straight to the point that I think you should land at. It was more like, God, I don't know who's in there. I don't know who's in there.
Exactly.
But I'll stay long enough to find out.
I'll watch long enough to find out. Yeah, exactly.
What books had you read before that that had helped you understand?
I don't think there's anything that helped me.
Like respond to that.
I mean, it's not that hard to respond to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the very reason that you said. And I actually can't think of a work of literature that would have been the preparation. And maybe that's why it was so interesting too. And also because it wasn't fiction, it was a scientist, you know, in psychology and science, a scientist's discovery of a person. So I actually, it's a great question what led me to be prepared to read it, but I can't think of anything.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of like Pip and Great Expectations or something, like a lone kid who's unknown to all, and you know, that it's going to take somebody stopping long enough. Do you think everyone in the class where you read it received it the way you did? Did it have an impact on everyone else?
Boy, that's another great question. I don't remember that. You know, I just remember my experience with it, and it was well beyond what the class was offering me.
Do you still have it?
You know, I think, no.
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 I can't believe you don't keep your books. I would think that you would keep every book you've ever written, and you'd be writing in all of them.
I keep a lot of books, but I don't have that book. No.
Did you know much about psychology before you read that book?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I really didn't.
And that'll have to wrap up today's edition of the Journal. Hope you enjoyed this segment from PRX Public Radio Exchange, the podcast Kelly Corrigan Wonders. Particularly enjoyed the first portion of that segment with the insight on the book by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We hope you take some time to celebrate the legacy and honor Dr. King in his peace mission and his hope for equality for all humans and civil rights. We have more on the way. This is WHFR. Stay with us on the WHFR Dearborn's own 89.3 FM. Do be well. Take care. Go Lions, of course. And we look forward to seeing you next week on another edition of the Journal. Be well and stay warm, everybody.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Time. That's where my